Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, February 2nd, 2016. The Iowa caucuses are behind us. And our opening music, which I found on Spotify, is from a group called Coral 11. And it's a sweet little tune called Here in Iowa. It was a real squeaker, a cliffhanger determined on the Democratic side by six flips of a coin. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, the big picture about Iowa. This is a massive farce for this tiny state, which is not representative of the broader nation, either for Republicans or Democrats, gets to hold the first process, which isn't even an election. It is this bizarre caucus process that nobody understands, that is different for Democrats and Republicans, and the data that are derived from it don't make any sense. And to have this little state wagging the proverbial dog of the U.S. of A. for so many years is something that somebody's got to change. And every time we go through this primary process, we look at how weird it is and how twisted and unrepresentative it is, and then we forget about it until the next primary season comes around and we just go through it again. So, I won't waste too much more time on this, but I will note that I just got the latest issue of the February edition of Harper's Magazine and a cover story called The Trouble with Iowa, bylined Richard Manning, has a pull quote here that I just cannot resist. There are about 21 million hogs in Iowa. Each produces the waste of about 2.5 people, meaning Iowa bears the shit equivalent of 15 times its human population. Well, the shit hit the fan for both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, who performed well below their own expectations. And I mentioned the coin toss, not one, not two, but in six different precincts. And I do not, I wish I could explain all this to you, but in six different precincts, they flipped a coin to determine who would be named the winner in that particular precinct. And I don't get this. Let me just read this quote to you, all right? At one of the precincts near Des Moines, a total of 484 eligible caucus attendees were recorded. But when each candidate's preference group was counted, Clinton had 240, Sanders 179, and Martin O'Malley had 5. Now, because he was considered non-viable, those 5 people were up for grabs and could have been assigned either Clinton or Sanders, but it wouldn't have changed the outcome. And Clinton had a clear lead here. Now, this is described as a discrepancy, I don't get that, that prompted the precinct leaders to call a Democratic Party hotline in order to find out how to handle it. And they were told to flip a coin. And they did, and Clinton won over Sanders in that particular precinct 2-4 Ames. But And I don't know the details of how close the other 5 precincts were, coin tosses were used to find the final result. I don't know how close those were. But when you couple this with the late-night report that the state Democratic Party, using a Microsoft phone app, was unable to offer results for 90 precincts in an election, you know, divided by a razor-thin margin. Well, it is once again just utterly ridiculous that the tabulation of these votes didn't occur properly or transparently, and the party asked both sides to help them reconstruct the missing results in those 90 precincts. Now, I don't know what happened between then and now, because all we have is the Associated Press announcing that Hillary Clinton won by the narrowest of margins. And what were those numbers? Well, Clinton was awarded 700.59 state delegate equivalents, whatever that means. So she had 700.5, and Sanders had 696.8. And O'Malley got 7.61. Now, the Sanders team is demanding the release of the raw vote counts, but in the past, the Democrats haven't done that. Bottom line, the Clinton campaign gets 23 of Iowa's delegates to the Democratic National Convention this summer, and Sanders picks up 21. But in this narrowest of victories, the Clinton campaign has to be licking its wounds, because the early polling showed her to be the odds-on favorite. She should have trounced Bernie Sanders. And once again, the Clintons are caught flat-footed in Iowa, where 8 years ago, John Edwards and Barack Obama put Hillary Clinton into third place. And while they'll spin this up as a victory, it's pretty clear that Sanders is going to win in New Hampshire. And from there, it's really an open race. Clinton has many advantages over Sanders, but will he pick up the intangible momentum that comes from this important score, let's just call it that, in Iowa, and a victory in New Hampshire? What does that mean in Nevada, South Carolina, and the March 1 Super Tuesday states? Well, there's a race here, and I think that's exciting. And while I favor Sanders over Clinton, and as you know, I've got my issues with Bernie, particularly on foreign policy, but he's the old guy with new ideas. And what it shows is that younger people are picking the old guy with new ideas over the younger female who's the establishment candidate. So in the demographic group of 17 to 29, I don't know why they start at 17. I think you have to be 18 to participate in the caucuses, but that could be a fine point that I'm not up to speed on. At any rate, the breakdown 17 to 29, Sanders got 84% of those votes, only 14% for Clinton. And it's almost the flip with seniors. Sanders gets 26% of the 65-plus vote, and Clinton nails down 69%. And when you look at this, turnout is a critical issue all the way forward on this campaign trail. High turnout will favor Sanders over Clinton. But also, he is really moving up, as I mentioned in yesterday's podcast. Demographically, Sanders is climbing the ladder and extending his support, particularly among women who were expected to break for Hillary on at least a 2-to-1 basis. And the split is edging up to the 50-year mark. And that is a very important factor in favor of Bernie Sanders. The other issue that I've mentioned before is that Hillary has virtually no room to grow. Everybody knows who she is, knows what they think of her. And even if some of that is erroneous, people will stick to their perceptions. And Bernie Sanders has room to grow. I argue that Hillary Clinton does not. And part of that is the history that she's been in public life so long and has so much baggage. And we each look at different aspects of that baggage. Some people look at the baggage and say, she's my gal. They manage to overlook all kinds of things. Yesterday, I used the term in denial to describe many Hillary Clinton supporters. And even up to, you know, the point last night where Clinton and Sanders both gave speeches, essentially claiming victory without explicitly saying so. In the hour before that, the Clinton campaign was saying, we've won, when it was too close to call even for Fox. And here I have to take a moment to ask the smug supporters of Secretary Clinton to adopt some humility Yesterday, there was a post on Facebook from a guy who said, let's just face it. Hillary's going to win. Sanders is going to lose. Let's not divide the party over this. Well, I'm sorry. It is not an entitlement for Hillary Clinton. And this shows that Bernie Sanders is highly competitive. And it's going to ebb and flow different states over the course of this primary. But it is not a lock for Hillary Clinton. And the sooner that her supporters recognize that, the better off they'll be. Because she's a good debater. She's very well qualified. She thinks fast on her feet. I don't support her policies, but that doesn't mean that I can't recognize her skills and her experience. And so let's have an honest debate. Let's argue the policies of single payer versus incremental improvements on the flawed Obamacare model. Let's talk about Sanders and his foreign policy, and let's force him to define himself. But let's not just, you know, rely on knee-jerk spin, campaign propaganda, a feminist sense of entitlement. There's a real race here. And I encourage all of my liberal, progressive, left-of-center friends, however you care to label yourselves, to put aside the vitriol. And it's fair to say there's some smug assholes for Sanders who stink up the social media. I don't deny that for a moment. But one more factor from the, they didn't do exit polls, they did entry polls for people attending the caucuses. And this is a really telling factor. Because 77% of the respondents believe that Hillary can win in November. Only 17% said that of Sanders. That's something he can turn around, but it is a liability for him at this point. On the issue of honesty and trustworthiness, though, Sanders scores 83% to Hillary Clinton's 10%. And I would argue that it's very difficult to turn that around. In the New York Times today, Frank Bruni, one of their op-ed columnists, who clearly thinks that Sanders can't win, he writes, Iowa was better terrain for Sanders than much of what lies ahead, and the dynamics that made Clinton a heavy favorite to be the nominee before the state's caucuses make her a heavy favorite still. But Iowa demonstrated yet again what a flawed and tarnished candidate she is. She should have trounced Sanders. Yes, he communicates authenticity to an electorate ravenous for it and has given potent voice to Americans' economic angst. But little in his Senate career, says Bruni, suggests that he'd be able to turn that oratory into remedy. And he notes that he's not charismatic. He's a 74-year-old self-proclaimed socialist. And he asks how to explain why Clinton, if she won, won by such a slim, the slimmest of margins. And he said that nothing in her speech looked forward as stirringly as her images looked backward. She's forever stressing that she's put up what she's put up with, what she's survived. I've been around a long time, she said. They throw all this stuff at me and I'm still standing. It's the language of drudgery and duty rather than inspiration. And she can sound as if she's collecting an IOU and asking voters to complete her trajectory rather than begin one of their own. Bill Clinton may well garner applause, but every time he stumps for her, it's an implicit promise to revisit yesterday, not to chart tomorrow. Bruni goes on, at this point, the Clintons are royalty, and royalty sits at a remove from all else. And I really think that it was such a boneheaded move for Hillary to take these huge six-figure speaking fees, not only from Wall Street and specifically Goldman Sachs, but she charged public universities $100,000 or $200,000 for a speech. And the Clintons have made so much money since they left the White House that she should have been smart enough to put that money into charity, maybe like the veterans' ploy that Trump used when he skipped the debate last week. But instead, she just took the money, which compromises her and makes her a rich so-and-so. I won't rhyme it with the B word. But it makes her a rich person who most people think has no sensitivity to their own issues and the struggles that they face. The Clintons don't need the money. They're awash in millions and millions of dollars. And I think that this speaks volumes about who she is. And I hope that her supporters will recognize her vulnerabilities and give Sanders a fair shot through this primary process. A lot of things have to break his way for him to win. I freely concede that. But if young people are energized and turn up and turn out, that's likely what will make the difference, and women will be the other key group who will determine the Democratic nominee. Speaking of Hillary Clinton, yesterday I was talking about the latest email report and the Inspector General's assertion that 22 of her emails were classified as top secret. And I mentioned that, it appears that these were retroactively classified. And somebody who knows much more about this than I do, and I'm honored that he's a regular listener to our podcast, is former NSA executive and whistleblower Russell Tice. And he wrote in response, he said, "Peter, this is not a case of retroactive classification, as with Sybil Edmonds and Tom Drake. It is a case where the header and footer classifications were stripped from the classified documents intentionally. In fact, it is very difficult to remove the classification lines, as the document producing software requires the classification lines in order to produce the documents. In other words, extra special and very unorthodox handling measures would have to be taken to script the classification lines and load it onto a low side like an internet access system. It's unrealistic to believe that Hillary Clinton did not know the classification lines were stripped out, because those documents would always have classification lines. If a document were unclassified, the header and footer would read unclassified. There are always classification lines on original documents. The real question is who ordered the classification lines to be stripped out before sending them to her home bathroom closet server. It would also be unrealistic to believe that it was anyone other than Clinton herself as Secretary of State who ordered the classification lines to be stripped out. This is what the FBI will focus on. This is what likely makes Hillary a felon on this email issue." Russ, thank you for the clarification. And with that information, it seems that the emails, beyond their contents, which concern me and should concern more people, the handling of the emails may present a huge legal liability, and you could see an effort to indict the former Secretary of State or a back-channel move at the Justice Department to prevent an indictment that could further muddy the waters as we approach the election in the fall. Well, Iowa did have the impact of forcing some candidates to accept reality. And I'm not talking about the phony reality of reality TV shows. But Martin O'Malley, grabbing really minuscule support in Iowa, who was showing up roughly at the 1% level, a little more in some counties, he announced that he is suspending his campaign for president. And I'm disappointed to see this, partly because my niece Hannah has been on his campaign staff and now she's unemployed. But I really felt that O'Malley deserved more support. And while Sanders is more appealing to me, I would think that there are many people who felt for various reasons they couldn't support Hillary, and that Martin O'Malley is a fresh face, a centrist guy, not too scary, younger. There are a lot of attributes about Martin O'Malley that are appealing. And I really don't understand why more Democrats were not drawn to him. So I give him credit for joining the race. He was quoted last night saying, "Katie and the kids and I decided it would be an extreme poverty indeed if the Democratic Party had only two candidates to choose from." And so we tried to give them a third choice. And somebody reprinted, it's at Vice, Vice News, a photo with caption from the Wall Street Journal last November. And it was behind the stage at one of the debates in a convention hall or someplace like that. And the picture caption reads, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and an unidentified man backstage at the Iowa Jefferson Jackson dinner. Well, the unidentified man was Martin O'Malley. And people couldn't figure out whether that was a joke or an editing error or maybe both. Well, on the Republican side, you can praise the Lord, you can say hallelujah, you can thump your Bible. Because Ted Cruz, whose father is a preacher and who acts like one on the campaign stump, he won the Iowa caucuses on the Republican side last night with record high turnout. And he delivered the reality blow to Donald Trump and his hair. And I see two factors here. That Cruz connected by pandering to the evangelical vote. That's what made Rick Santorum the oddball winner of Iowa 4 years ago. Santorum placed dead last among the Republicans last night. The other factor is that Cruz spent a lot of money and had a major organizing drive on the ground in Iowa. He says he hit all 99 counties. Marco Rubio came in late, and Donald Trump, who just, you know, likes to fly around and hold news conferences and use free television, he did spend some money on campaign commercials, but he relied mostly on the free coverage that he's gotten from all the networks to drive his campaign in Iowa. And what we show is that, yes, he has a base, yes, he has appeal, but it came in at the 24% range last night, not the 30-plus that the opinion polls had shown. So from this, we can reliably discount the conversion rate of Donald Trump's popularity numbers to actual numbers in voter participation, caucuses, or elections. So the ranking was 28 for Cruz, 24 for Trump, and a surprisingly close 23% for Marco Rubio. And Rubio went the revival route as well, invoking Jesus Christ as his Savior and all of that stuff. And I find this really offensive because, you know, everyone's entitled to their religious beliefs and practice. But to make them part of the political process denies me my freedom from religion. And it's scary to hear these people invoke Jesus and God as they talk about wiping out whole populations with carpet bombing, as they talk about removing health care with no substitute from millions of Americans. Is that what God would do? I just find it incoherent, but of course I'm not an evangelical, and I can't quite put myself in those goody-two-shoes. And Trump is down but not out. Like Sanders, he moves on to New Hampshire, where he's expected to score a big victory. And this campaign will continue. And I'll continue to cover it here. Here's where I pause to thank the people who support my work so I can keep covering the political process, whistleblower news, and the issues that I think are most important for voters in this critical year. And today I want to thank Pauline Nixon. Yes, we have support from a Nixon here. Also, Multitask Man, a monthly subscriber. And, gosh, I'm looking at a list of people who've canceled here. Let's name some names. Annette McManus, I'm going to miss you. Meg Middleton, a longtime supporter. George Martin, canceled. And by the way, January, which is usually a big month for annual subscriber renewals, we are off about $1,000 compared to last year in the month of January. So I'm not trying to make anybody feel guilty or feel bad, or I don't want to sound desperate. I'm not. But I need your help. I need your help and your support. Yes, I need you to kick in a few bucks here. So if you've been listening and you enjoy the work that I do, you appreciate the views and the analysis that I present, I invite you to support my work with a subscription at peterbcollins.com. Every day I tell you how to do it, so today I'll take the day off. Just go ahead and click on the menu button and take it from there. The White House has announced President Obama's final defense budget And there are a couple of alarming elements in it. The plans are to quadruple the amount of money spent in Central and Eastern Europe, sending a message to Russia that we're ready for the Cold War 2.0. The White House asking for $3.4 billion for military spending, and they want to send heavy armor and heavy weapons to NATO countries that have borders with or near Russia. Also, the Obama team is upping the war on, well, the budget for the war on the Islamic State by 35%, asking for $7 billion. Now, on the NATO support and the deployment of equipment to rattle Russia, here's a quote from Evelyn Farkas, the Pentagon's top policy official on Russia and Ukraine until she left in October. This is a really big deal, and the Russians are going to have a cow. Great. This is a perfect time to force the Russians to have a cow, isn't it? Now, also, between Europe and the United States, there is a new agreement that was supposed to be concluded by the end of last week, and it is supposed to provide safe harbor for the data that travels on the internets between the U.S. and Europe. And, of course, the real issue here, it's called the EU-US Privacy Shield, is will the NSA honor this agreement? Because we know that one of the ways they tap into the internet worldwide is to tap into the circuits, the fiber optic circuits that connect the U.S. and Europe and other points around the globe. And they go into those nodes and are able to basically monitor all of the traffic that is going through there. And so, while on the face of it, this will help American companies like Google and Amazon save face and continue to do business in Europe, well, we cannot predict how our own government and its super-secret spy agencies will treat this agreement. And it's, you know, in many respects, kind of an empty exercise. And I will note that while the Europeans demand privacy and protection from snooping from the United States, well, they're busy, hypocritically, violating the privacy of their own citizens. I mean, France is essentially under martial law right now. There is no privacy. And in Britain, where they don't have our First Amendment and other standards, well, the British have really run roughshod over the privacy rights of their own citizens. Germany really seems to be the most praiseworthy of these countries in terms of respecting its citizens' privacy. But even there, we know that the U.S. has won collaboration from Germany in surveillance of its own citizens. In Israel, the bulldozers rolled this morning and demolished 23 houses in the West Bank. Described as the biggest demolitions in the past decade, this is the long-running dispute over towns that existed before Israel did, and certainly before the Israeli occupation of the West Bank in 1967. And the same group of homes were destroyed. The entire village, Kirbet Jenba, was destroyed by Israel in 1999. But the Palestinians are persistent and determined. One of them, who lost his home, Khalid Jabari, said, "They came the day before and marked the houses for demolition. We knew it was serious because some of the villagers who understand Hebrew heard the soldiers talking about how the buildings were going to be destroyed. I was a few towns away when I heard the news at 3:30 a.m. this morning. I just got back here when the bulldozers arrived, just after 5 a.m. Also in Israel, a kind of loyalty test. A new wave of McCarthyism appears to be unleashed, and this is driven by a woman, a former military general, who has taken over as the head of a cultural group. Her name is Regev, R-E-G-E-V, And she has said that she's promoting a program called Loyalty in Culture. And a far-right group last week attacked a group of liberals and called them moles in culture. So Miri Regev, who is the conservative minister of culture and sport, is spearheading this effort to basically marginalize people who don't accept the positions of the extreme, the radical government in Israel. And so it's going to be interesting to see if there is enough pushback to scuttle this, or if the people who demand loyalty and dogmatic thinking and behavior will prevail. Now, this is a case that I want to freely tell you I don't know a whole lot about. My comment is not on the specifics of this case, but the bigger picture. So in a federal courtroom in Virginia, the appeals court just produced some rulings related to the trial of Colonel Yusuf Abdi Ali, who was head of the Somali Army's 5th Brigade back in the 1980s. He is being tried as a war criminal and accused of torture. And the ruling dismissed charges of mass atrocities, but left standing charges of personal wrongdoing. But for me, the issue is the big picture here. Why are we conducting a trial of a guy from Somalia? Shouldn't it be in the International Court for Human Rights? And what standard does it show, does it set, that we're trying a Somali for torture that occurred more than 30 years ago, and we will not even investigate the obvious crimes of torture that occurred in our own country by our own leaders during the aughts, during the Bush-Cheney administration? I find that embarrassing for any American to consider. The Environmental Protection Agency is getting blowback from 31 independent scientists who just reviewed their draft report. And the draft report says that hydraulic fracturing has no widespread systemic impacts on drinking water. But the scientists say that the summary is inconsistent with the observations, data, and levels of uncertainty in the report. And the scientists say that the EPA needs to explain what happened in Dimock, Pennsylvania, Pavilion, Wyoming, Parker County, Texas, where it's pretty clear that the water was poisoned by frackers. And the EPA, of course, responding to lobbyists and pressure from industries, is just kind of ducking the whole issue. One of the scientists, quote, says, "We are concerned that these major findings are presented ambiguously within the executive summary and are inconsistent with the observations, data, and levels of uncertainty expressed in the full report." So this is a case where they're spinning the summary to meet the demands of perhaps the White House, but at least the industries that are regulated. And the details, the science, that's not important. You can leave that out of the press release, and you can rely on the corporate media not to look beyond the press release. A couple of days ago, the United Nations once again expressed deep regret and shame as we learned of 6 new cases brought forward in the Central African Republic, accusing UN peacekeeper troops of sexually abusing children, including a report of a 7-year-old girl who said she had to perform sexual acts on soldiers in exchange for water and cookies. Now, this is the second round, maybe even the third, of these troubling reports. And again, zooming out to the big picture, on Saturday night, the SAG Awards honored the film Spotlight, which is an excellent movie. If you haven't seen it, please do. It covers the work of the Boston Globe's investigative team as they took on the powerful Archdiocese of Boston and exposed the criminal cover-up of pedophile priests who were allowed to prey on victims, then moved to another parish where they could do it again. and in particular the role of Bernard Law, who was the archbishop there, now a cardinal, residing comfortably in Rome, and has never been charged for his complicity in these dastardly deeds. And why is it that humans who get into a position of power, whether they are priests with a Roman collar or UN peacekeepers with a powder blue helmet, what is it that makes them want to exploit and hurt children in this manner? I just don't know. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast today. Please share it far and wide. I'll be much obliged. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.